Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, and welcome to the Ask the Industry podcast, episode 126. I'm comedian Simon Kane, and for those of you new to the show, this is the podcast where I interview the most influential people from the worlds of stand-up, comedy, radio, and today, TV production. Anthony Butler is the founder of Broken Robot Productions and is the head of live entertainment at Graham Norton's production company, SoTV. He's also the former comedy booker and promoter at Off the Curb, where he booked their vast network of university gigs, as well as Live at the Apollo, and so much more. This is going to be a big one. This is full of advice, like how to get on Live at the Apollo, what TV production houses really do to scout, how you start your own TV production company, and why and when you should, and so much more. I think there's something in here for everyone, so I really just want to dive straight in. What I will say is, if you can leave us a new review, that'd be really appreciated. 5 stars, ideally, but if not, a 4-star review, which reads like a 5, would be just as good. And if you wanted to donate to keep this podcast going, every little helps. So if you could donate £1, either as a one-off donation via PayPal, or you could donate $1 every single episode. I really want to push up the patrons. I really want to get some more money to fund better shows and keep the quality going. So if you can do that and you can help this community grow, please do not hesitate to get involved. If you're new here, please don't forget to hit that subscribe button. If you're old here, please do consider to give us an honest, ideally positive review in iTunes. And either way, please do join the Facebook group. It's called Ask the Industry Podcast, and it's on Facebook, obviously. But for now, this is Anthony Butler.
So I first came up to the Fringe in 2005 with Off the Curb, and it's been one of the sort of most consistent things that I've done, I guess. So I did a number of years with them, and then when I started So Comedy with So Television, founded their live department in 2012, it was the first sort of proper live projects that we did. So it's always been quite an important part of what I've done, and it's kind of sort of grown sort of over the years that I've done it with, you know, for So initially, and now producing with So. I think it's important in part because it's great fun to do, and it's but I think more than that, it's often the starting point. I think a lot of people see the Fringe as being the end of a sort of cycle of work, but it's not really. It's the start of it. I think it's whether that's because you're going to go straight on and do a tour afterwards, or whether it's at the start of a relationship with an artist that you're working with. So from my point of view as a producer, promoter, that's kind of what the Fringe is. And of course, there are shows where they are one-off things. They're things that only will work at the Fringe, and they're you know, and those are things you want to do as well. So it can be the event in itself. But I think more often than not, the Fringe in one way or another is something that is a foundation for other work and other projects that you're going to do.
Completely, yeah. I mean, when I first came up, I saw it as, okay, I've leveled up. I've done the year, and now I have to start a new one. And now because I book a tour directly after, and usually that sort of, and also inviting industry to see me usually leads to more club work later on in the year, especially sort of December, January time when there's, you know, corporate things happening. And I find looking at it that way means that I actually have less time in a year to write a show because you know what I mean? Like you kind of, it runs into itself. They sort of cross over quite a lot. And so how do you balance sort of looking at the year, say bring up a show for an artist, how do you balance looking at this show's project with maybe them saying, but I also want to do a new one next year?
Well, I think you have to look at the scheduling very carefully when it comes to something like that. I think a lot of the time, if you are doing, I think it depends on how big the tour is going to be is a big part of it. And also when you've decided, I'm definitely going to do a tour after Edinburgh. I think the reality is if you've decided you want to do a tour at the end of Edinburgh, you go, right, I'm now going to tour. That's not going to be until the spring. Mm. And you have to then weigh up very carefully as an artist with your other live work, other TV work, whatever else you're doing, whether you do have enough time to then write a brand new show. Mm. I think it's a lot easier actually if you've, you know, and I suppose if you're an artist of a certain profile and a certain level of experience, then you probably can decide before you've been to the Fringe that you're definitely going to tour afterwards. And that makes it a much more sort of simpler thing to do because you can then plan the year in advance. So if you want to sort of go on that cycle of Edinburgh tour, yeah, which isn't right for everyone, but yeah, for a lot of people, that's what they want to do. So it's all, I think it all comes down to when the decision's made, and then you sort of have to work backwards from there.
Yeah, totally. And I know you were involved in the university tour circuit. You were the booker for that.
Oh, when I was with the Curb. Yeah.
I was wondering how, because obviously university has sort of exploded in the time that you were there, and it was sort of, and also there was issues with, you know, fees and people being able to go and all that sort of stuff that came out of it. But essentially universities blew up and had lots more people going to them. And I wonder whether that helped with comedy, whether that meant the sort of, whether that meant the sort of people coming to it had changed, whether that meant the booking policy was different.
I think what's really interesting in the, I don't know, 14 years or so that I've been doing it is that whole, the circuit thing in general, not just the university circuit, but the club circuit in general. I mean, when I was first doing the clubs, which was, as I say, was around probably 2005 sort of onwards for 3 or 4 years, there were, you know, there was 100, we were booking about 150, 160 shows a year, shows a year. And then there were tons of club nights that we were booking as well. Mm. I think what you've seen happen, I mean, it's no secret that there are far fewer club gigs around in general. I mean, I think that particular circuit is still going strong, but there definitely are fewer gigs. So I think whilst the university thing is helpful in some ways, I tell you what it is, I think that, and this is a theory I've got, and I could be totally wrong on this theory, is that I think that the younger audiences, whilst they are happy to spend money on comedy, they're less inclined to spend it on club nights. I think they're more, I think that you could have a small tour, which, because they've seen someone on a podcast, or heard someone on a podcast, seen someone on YouTube, or they've perhaps seen them on a TV show, but probably more likely the former, that they will buy a ticket for a tour. And that tour probably wouldn't have existed 10, 12 years ago because the circuit was probably much in a healthier state. And I think it's just about where people spend their money, and young people spend their money in particular. So I think, yes, the university circuit is really important, but I suspect it will evolve, that the university tour circuit will become quite literally that, an actual tour circuit rather than a club circuit, because I've got no hard evidence to back this up, but it's just a sort of hunch I get that the younger crowds are more inclined to spend their 15 quid a month or whatever on a solo tour of someone they've seen through whatever, you know, platform they've seen them on, rather than a club night. But I don't know, what do you think?
I was gonna say I think that's probably right for a section of especially young people, students and above, because I think you get a different story from saying that you went to see someone's tour show versus you went to a club night. I think the story of I think real comedy nerds, and I say that with all love and care, because I am one of them, would go to a comedy night and being able to go, oh, I went to the comedy store and I found this person, I really like that person, I didn't like that person, like they'll like that story. But I think there's a lot more people who maybe spread out what they go and see. So they'll go and see comedy once a month, and, you know, music once a month, or save up for a festival. So they'll want the story of, oh, I picked to go and see this comedian, and then if people haven't heard of it, they're going to go, oh, now I got to tell you about this one comedian that, you know, is my favourite, or whatever it is. Do you know what I mean?
Like, no, I absolutely do. I think it comes from there being ways of building fan bases that there weren't.
Yeah.
Your way of building a fan base was, or to build an audience really, was to do the club circuit and then get on television as a result of doing the club circuit and then start touring, or having a really good Edinburgh and winning an award and start touring. And I just think that is still a route, and I'm not saying that route doesn't exist, but I think that is now one of a number of routes, and it's not necessarily the one where most people are getting a touring career directly from.
Yeah, I think I think because it's one of those things where I think because so many people have seen that route happen for people, and they've not seen it happen for many people, they've just seen it, you know, actively happen for maybe, you know, half a dozen acts, they think, I'll follow that. And I think when you know, a few thousand people follow that route, it becomes a bit saturated and you have to find other means. And thankfully now with the internet, you know, there are other means. So that, you know, like Twitter or YouTube, as you mentioned, you know. I mean, how when you're scouting for acts, how much of that takes into play? Are you active on social media? Are you looking for things like that?
I mean, you do. I mean, I think with me, when it's sort of scouting for acts, it's a far more organic thing than that. I don't sort of consciously go, right, I'm going, you know, because I book for TV as well. I think a lot of TV bookers do is, oh, I'm working on this show, or I know I'm about to work on this show, so I'll scout for acts. I think for me, because I'm sort of from that the live world sort of primarily, it's a slightly more organic process, because I am at those comedy clubs anyway, and I'm here for the month, I'm at the Fringe for the month every year, and so I think that it's something that I just sort of do anyway. So I don't sort of actively go, oh, I must go to see, you know, 20 shows because one of them might be someone that I'd book. I'm going to 20 shows because that's what I do, you know, just because of that's who I am. It's just the world I come from. So I think it's, but to answer your question about the social media things, yeah, I think you do have to keep an eye on that. I still think going to gigs is the way that I first and foremost would see, certainly stand-up talent.
Yeah.
But then, you know, comedy talent and people that tour are coming from different places now, and there are people that are touring very successfully who are not principally live performers. So I think you have to be open to, you know, open to looking at those other platforms in order to see who's out there and see who can be touring and everything that goes with it.
Completely. I think I was just chatting with Jason from Avalon the other day, and we were talking about how there's a misconception when they make TV shows that they only book their own act. And I wondered if you could either disperse that rumour or confirm that rumour that, say, for example, when Off the Curb are working on a show, or when someone's booking it, whether they only book their own acts or whether they actually are looking for other things.
No, I don't think that's true. I don't think that's true of any of the big companies that do it. I mean, I think the problem you've got with, if you're one of the big agencies that also has a TV division, is that if you're making a TV show, a broadcaster is going to want certain names and certain, you know, types of names, and there's a high chance that you're going to represent some of them. But I think it's unfair to any of those sort of big agencies to say they only book their own talent on shows. I mean, it's just evidently not the case. I mean, if you look at if you look at Russell Howard's show, you look at Live at the Apollo, you look at any of those, they've got a real mix of it, and of course there are some of their clients on there
naturally,
but I would always argue that if that show was being made by a completely different company, those clients probably would still be on there just by virtue of who they are and where they are in their careers. And it's, you know, I've certainly never come across anyone having a booking policy of just keeping it internal. You couldn't book a series like it. So I don't think that's true at all.
I understand
why other people might feel that that's the case, and might genuinely perceive that to be the case. But I don't think it is.
No, I was going to ask if you could see why, from an outsider point of view, why some people, personally, I you know, if you just look at the names, it's very easy to Google and see if they're with you.
Yeah.
Like, it's really not that much research. You just have open in a tab and then, you know, just look for it yourself. But I can understand why. I don't know. I feel like there's that sort of the quote unquote old boys club thing. I feel like there can be that perception where it's like, well, you've got your production house, you've got your thing, and you churn out trying to boost the careers of your performers. And to be honest with you, when people say it like that, I go, of course they do. Like, you know, if they've got a performer they want to break or put forward, of course, if they've got a TV show and they can put them on, they're going to do that. It doesn't make any sense why they wouldn't. And sort of brings me on to my next question about whether TV actually breaks acts anymore, whether it's because TV viewing figures are down, there's more opportunity to see things on demand players, Netflix are investing much more in the space, podcasts are sort of growing, and Spotify's trying to get into it. Where do you see your role in the future, and where do you see TV's role?
I think TV's role is different to what it was, purely on the basis that TV, well, and radio, but TV in particular, was the sole means that you would become famous essentially from, and that's not the case, absolutely not the case anymore. I still think TV can give you a massive boost. You know, there's no doubt that if you've got you know, if you get books on those big comedy shows, then you are going to be reaching a bigger audience than you've reached by doing live. I think it's difficult, because the thing that you would use to sort of, the given was that you get books on one of those big shows, you then become a successful touring act, and that was kind of a given. And I think the difficult thing now is that you don't know whether that's going to happen or not. I think it probably takes more TV appearances for you to have the impact that you would have had 15 years ago by having one of those TV appearances. Mm-hmm. That said, I don't. What's great about how things have evolved is that you don't necessarily have to have one of those TV appearances to get to that point of touring. Mm-hmm. You can kind of do it yourself a bit more. Mm-hmm. And so I think TV's role is still there and is still important and will still be the way that people can become, you know, a big touring act. But as I say, I think there's just multiple other ways that you can do it. And if you look at the, you know, the success of some of the podcasts, I think that's the other interesting thing as well, actually, is you might have a world in which you might not be touring your stand-up, but you might be touring your podcast, for example. So it might be you've got a different route, and on the back of touring that podcast very successfully, then you do your stand-up on the back of that. So I think it's there's perhaps a bigger chain rather than just going, I'm very funny, I'll go on TV and then I'll be able to be a touring act. But it does still exist. I think my personal role, I mean, because I kind of have a foot in each yeah. camp, I guess, is just sort of seeing how, I think from a life point of view, things don't change tremendously, actually. I think it's just how you find and build the talent you're working with that changes. Mm. I don't think the actual mechanics of touring changes massively as a result, but it's just how you kind of go about finding the people to tour and what you tour and how you grow those tours. Completely. Especially if someone as any clients that I work with, it's always with the aim of doing it with over a long-term period. Mm-hmm. So you want to have a bit of a strategy in place. I think the strategy might be slightly different, but the actual mechanics of it day to day don't really change massively, I don't think. From a booking point of view, yeah, I guess it kind of does change a bit. I think with stuff I do in terms of broadcast stuff I do, I think I have been involved in some podcasts, which isn't something that when I started I thought I would be, probably because they didn't exist when I started. But the TV booking's still there, you know, it's still, I think it is still an important thing, but you just want there to be, I mean, it'd be nice if there were more platforms for it, I guess.
Yeah, I was wondering, and this might be two different answers, it might be your personal answer and the professional answer, if that makes sense. But a lot of people who have YouTube channels, who maybe even remain anonymous, pirate TV show sets, you know, like stand-up sets, and put them online, so that people who maybe life is on the iPlayer and they can't be seen elsewhere in the world, people are able to see them. And there's obviously the advantages of, like, you know, oh, all of a sudden it goes viral in Japan, and you know, you could tour, you know, there's that Searching for Sugar Man thing, you know, he was nothing in America but amazing in another country. So I suppose there's advantages there, but there's disadvantages in the sense that they are pirating your content and they are stealing, you know, potentially burning a comedian's set in a way that it wouldn't necessarily need to if it hadn't got as much pickup on TV. So I wondered whether you see that as something that would be of interest to your productions or productions you might work on in the future. In other words, taking something and putting it out as the high quality, like Monty Python have done, you know, where they've got their own YouTube channel now, and they're putting out the high quality versions of clips to try and become more relevant and get more sales. Or whether you think, actually, no, I don't like it when people pirate the work that I put on TV on YouTube or whatever it is.
I mean, I think there's a big difference between pirating something which is an existing production, you know, as in a film's production, and pirating something which it has been from a stand-up set. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it comes down to the, to a large extent, it comes down to the quantity of material that's used. I think that, I mean, obviously the right answer is no, someone should not be pirating anyone's material. And that said, I think that, as you say, there are, people have benefited from it. And I think if you are an act who hasn't currently got a huge following and someone chooses to put you on that platform, there are definitely benefits to that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm slightly skeptical as to how much the international thing works. Of course, there are examples, but I think those examples are few and far between. Mm-hmm. So I think the argument of, oh, it's gone viral and it means you can go and tour in the States or whatever it might be, I think that's always going to be very, very unlikely to happen. I think there's one in a million chance that you'll get that from it. I think what you are more likely to get from it is greater exposure in the territories that you're already working. So I think it's, I mean, I suppose by and large, I don't think it's a good thing to be pirating people's material, but I think there are probably examples in which it can happen. I think that what would probably be better if some of those people that are doing those things were to try and build up a better relationship with the performers in the first place, so it isn't pirating it, but the outcome is the same. I guess that's not how they work, but you know what I'm saying. Yeah. It becomes, I think there is an avenue which can can help, but it's probably not ideal if you're not consenting to it in the first place.
So you mean like if I think Arseraptor's the biggest one on YouTube that I know of that sort of pirates a lot of. I've no affiliation, but I'm just aware of it because you know it does a lot of that. So you think that a channel like that should try and maybe contact agents or agencies and basically say, look, we've been doing this for years. It's getting loads of views. Would you like the exposure? Or how would
I guess so. I mean, it's. I think when you're at the point of I think just building stronger relationships with the industry in general. I mean, I think that. I mean, the other thing with YouTube is you can always request things taken down. You do always have that. So if something's becoming big and you really don't want your content there, you can always take it down. I mean, the underlying rule is you shouldn't really be putting other people's content up. I don't really fully understand why, if you've got a massive following, loads of subscribers, you wouldn't want to reach out to them. And I think in a lot of cases, you probably get a fairly positive response. I think where that sort of thing can go wrong is when you're just saying, oh, I've got this half hour set from a preview that someone's sort of, however they've got hold of it, and we're putting that up. And that's where it's not right, I think. I think if you're using a really short clip, then that probably is of much bigger benefit. But of course, if you're doing it without people's consent, then how do you know what they're happy with and what they're not? So I think there's a big argument for channels like that building stronger relationships with industry and with the artists and with the agents to some extent as
well.
And as a promoter, that's sort of slightly sort of separate really from me, because I'll get supplied with that by the performers that I work with. But it's an interesting question. But I think that's probably the best way of it moving forward and it being good for everyone, because it can be.
Completely. And when you are looking for an act, or when you are booking an act for TV, do you basically say to them, hey, we're going to give you 15, 20 minutes, half an hour, whatever it is to do your comedy in front of an audience. We'll record it, edit it down. If you want to be involved, do you involve them in the edit? Is it a case of you say, I've seen you do this set, I want that set, or do you just go, do whatever you want?
It's normally, it does vary, but normally it is a case of saying, well, look, we've seen you, this is the bit of the set that we would want. I mean, you're not too prescriptive about it. You're not literally saying, it's this joke followed by this joke this routine. But it is saying, look, this is the bit of the show or the bit of your club set or whatever it might be that we feel will work. Some of it just doesn't translate to TV. Some stuff works far better in a live environment than it does on telly, and and vice versa. So you do to some degree sort of curate the set, but it's not a case of micromanaging it.
No.
And it is always cut down. So you would probably heavily advise as to what you want that set to be made up, usually around 20 minutes, and cut it down to about 10, 8 or 10.
No, I'm wondering how political correctness and social trends in what is okay to say and what isn't okay to joke about has impacted what you're able to book or what people are able to say on TV.
I think when it comes to that kind of thing, it's you're more likely. I think performers have a certain style and a certain tone that they take. So I think it's very unlikely you're going to come into an instance where you say, well, we're going to book that person, but we want to censor this bit of your set or that bit of your set. I think that a show that you're booking is going to have a certain tone. You're going to be booking performers that match that sort of editorial brief, and as a result of that, you're probably not going to have too much censorship over their set. It's probably far more going to come down to what works creatively than than what works from other from other points. I don't think for the most part you need to censor people. Of course, there are limits on how much swearing you can have and that kind of thing. But no, in terms of the actual content and the themes of the stand up, I think that if someone's got a certain theme that they run with and that's totally at odds with the show you're making, then you're probably not going to book them for it, rather than book them for it and then basically try to change everything that they do. So I don't think for them, I mean, it has an impact perhaps on the who you're booking to some degree, but once booked, I don't think it influences how much you edit what they're saying on stage.
Completely. I mean, and that sort of brings me on nicely to quotas, and I think that has been a really interesting thing that's been implemented on the self-regulated really within the industry. I feel like they're doing it largely for their own, like within themselves. They're not really having Ofcom go, you must have, especially like with the BBC and the one woman on panel shows and the ITV move recently where it's no all male writers rooms. I feel like journalism is slightly hurting those moves just because they're sort of for clickbait, sort of sensationalizing what, you know, quotas and people are. Sorry, right. It's like day nine of the Fringe and I'm already losing my voice.
No, that right.
But I wondered whether quotas have started to impact your work with So or with your production company, or whether it's, or for the better or for worse, or how you're finding navigating that new area, because I assume it's just a production brief that's slightly changed rather than a...
I think when it comes to the... I think the biggest problem has been the press sort of drawing attention to what the industry was sort of doing, rightly doing anyway. I think that it's not even a question of course there should be equal number of women on panel shows and on stand-up shows. Mm. It's a given. I think where what's been probably less than ideal is when you have sort of these sensational headlines about certain panel shows always having, you know, an equal number of female contributors or whatever it might be, because I think it slightly undermines the sort of legitimate good booking of good female comedians. Do you know what I mean? I don't think it is a case of quotas. I think that it's a case of booking really good comedians,
yeah, yeah,
and half of them being women. Mm. I think that when newspapers and the press start to make a huge deal about it and implying, well, whatever it is they're implying, mm, it does start to sort of undermine what's going on, basically. Yeah. I think that it shouldn't be portrayed as, oh well, there's a certain quota. It should just be portrayed as there are lots of very good comedians, and they're, you know, some of them are men and some of them are women, and that TV shows should reflect that. And I think when it's portrayed as being, oh well, TV's doing this to quota fill, that's actually a negative thing and a sort of slightly harmful thing, and undermine what television is doing, which is actually probably just addressing something that should have been addressed, you know, a long time ago. So I don't really see it as a quota filling thing. I think it's just sensible booking, basically.
I think what annoys me about it is, and you hear it up here a lot, where, you know, if someone gets nominated, they go, oh, it's because they're a woman, for example.
Right.
It's because they're either trying to validate why they didn't get nominated, for example, or whatever it is, or they're trying to undermine someone else's hard work because they're like, oh, well, you know, there's quotas for that, or whatever it would be.
That's exactly what I mean. It's sort of, and I think that's... You're absolutely right, but I think when it comes to TV, that's heightened because it's something the public are more aware of, and the newspapers are more likely to report on. I certainly never feel when I'm booking a TV show that I'm got to go, oh well, I must make sure I've got, you know, this demographic or that demographic. No. Yeah. It's a case of just booking a show well and having good people on it. And actually, if you're doing that organically, you will have. You know, you should have a good balance, because the whole argument of, oh well, there aren't people that you can book on the shows. It's just not true.
No, completely. And the circuit, I think my personal, if I was slightly break from interview and be personal for a second, my personal outsider view of the TV industry is that it's slightly disconnected from the live circuit in general, and I think that's a frustration that a lot of live acts have, is that, you know, it seems, and I say this as a younger comedian, you know, in terms of like my career and in terms of my age, you know, I think it does look on the outside to favour younger comedians at the moment, and I think there's that misconception of, you know, well, a comedian's been going 40 years, ideally should be put on things because they're probably better, and so I think that's also another issue that I have to get over in my head, because obviously, like you said, realistically, it's just me making reasons for why I'm not on it, probably. You know, it's just, you know, I don't know. But I think everyone's got their own reason for why they think they didn't get booked and for why that person did. And I think when a journalist comes up with that reason, it can be much more damaging than when two comedians go, oh, I didn't get it because they're booking, you know, comedians of colour this month, or whatever it is.
Right.
Does that make sense?
I think a performer is always going to sort of analyse why they're not booked for something. But I think more broadly, I think, think what? So I don't really know what the question.
I was only asking as to I suppose the question there was where do you stand on listening to those sort of feedback loops of people
from comics,
but also and I suppose this builds off from there because we're going to get in social media in a sec or back in social media. Do you search for the act's name after shows, and do you take into account how positive or negatively they did from the general public?
Yeah, I mean, you absolutely take on board how well they did in the room. Although you know, I suppose you have to balance that with not every room is right. You know, I've seen brilliant sets get nothing and die a death, and I've seen really mediocre sets, you know, storm it. And I think you have to always sort of take the balance of your own kind of opinion versus how something lands in the room versus kind of how they're doing more broadly. You know, if someone has got I always take the view that it's as a booker, or as you know, as a producer, you can't solely go, oh well, my taste is this and therefore I book this. You can't book in that way. What you have to be is very objective about it and say, well, you know, on balance, was that a good set or not? On balance, are they consistently, you know, storming rooms on the circuit or in Edinburgh? And I think if the answer to that is yes, they are, then you book them on that basis. I always, whenever I see a show, I always sort of make a note of it. I've got a notebook that has pretty much got my sort of scribbled down sort of thoughts and notes of anyone I ever see. So you do those things, but I think you have to be objective about it because it's you cannot book on just your personal taste.
Completely. And how do you feel about laugh tracks?
I don't have an especially strong opinion, to be honest with you. In television terms.
Yeah, in television terms.
I think it's I think people think that laugh tracks are used to a far greater extent than they actually are.
I think that as well.
It's fairly
obvious when they are as well.
It's fairly obvious when they are, and it's not often used. I think when laugh tracks are used, it's generally used as an editing device more than to make someone seem massively funnier than they actually were on the night. Mm. It's very rare at a TV recording. Mm-hmm. There's a very different audience at a TV recording than you have in a live environment. Mm-hmm. TV recording audiences do tend to organically laugh more at things than a live crowd might. So I think there is a perception that TV manipulates things and makes people appear to have a far better show than they do. That doesn't really happen, to be honest with you. Of course, laugh tracks are used, but laugh tracks are, as I say, generally used as just a device to edit a show, and they're usually taken from. I mean, canned laughter doesn't really exist. It's always used from the show that you're working on. But it's not really. I don't think any show I've ever worked on has manipulated a set to the extent that someone that died a death actually had an amazing show. Certainly not that I've been conscious of, anyway.
No, I think you're right about the first point, in that I think people think they just use a lot more than they are. And I think that, again, just comes out of a lack of being involved in it, and also just maybe they've never... So, like, I record a lot of my sets just in clubs and things to watch them back and whatever, and I see a lot of people putting them on YouTube and stuff, and you think, you know, you can see that there's been no editing to the audio or to anything because they've just literally put the thing straight up online.
Yeah.
And you can kind of tell when people are... even in Adobe Premiere, just turning up the sort of audio or whatever. Yeah. It's really so obvious.
But I think that's the difference between something you're recording from a club set and putting on YouTube versus a TV recording. It's not that I think there is a huge difference between manipulating a YouTube clip and having that really obvious thing where the laughter suddenly sounds a lot louder than you are on the mic, or one is on the mic. With TV, that isn't really that doesn't really happen. So I think there's a difference between the two. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, this idea that on TV shows there's just this canned laughter just sort of whacked on every edit is just not true. It's always you always have the laughter track from the actual show. But of course, the show is edited, so it's cut to that extent. But not to the extent that you're making a not very good set sound like it's getting a huge laugh. And as a rule as well, TV shows won't have not very good sets because it is being edited, for one, so you keep in the funny stuff.
Yeah.
And because it has been, I wouldn't say more carefully curated, but it's there's probably a greater amount of time goes into booking a TV show than when you're booking, and I'm talking to someone that books live gigs as well as TV shows. You do spend longer looking at making sure that lineup is absolutely perfect on a TV show than with a live show, where it is, you know, it's one of a run of live shows. So it's a slightly different, it's just a slightly different way of going about booking it.
Completely. And that brings us on to SoTV and your connection with them. So maybe if you give like a potted history of when you worked with them and now where you work in them and now with them.
I joined So in 2011, 2012, doing TV work with them, talent booking, but also we set up a live division, So Comedy. And then basically that's just sort of evolved over the years. And I've subsequently set up my own company, Broken Robot, and I now work in partnership with So on the live output. So Comedy and Broken Robot basically effectively co-produce, co-promote the shows that we bring up to Edinburgh, the tours we take out on the road. And so it's kind of an extension of the relationship that we've already always had.
Yeah, and in terms of your relationship with the TV work then, for example, with So, If you're developing a new show, or even if you wanted to start developing a new show, how does that process work? Do you just go, because obviously they're basically a production house, not a TV channel. So obviously there's chicken and egg on, is a TV channel looking for, let's say, a chat show?
Yeah.
If they are, let's develop one. Or do you just go, actually, we've got a really good idea, let's take it to everyone and see who's got space. How do you work that?
I think it's the former more than the latter as a rule. I mean, I'm not talking exclusively for So here, just in general, I think the way it works is there are not infinite number of slots available. And you might have the best idea in the world, but if it's not going to fit the slot, then, you know, there's a limit on what you can do with that. You know, there will be, if a channel is, you generally know there are, and by slots I mean specific broadcast slots, as well as genres that they're looking for. So you'll generally know what they're, you know, what they're looking for, and you will work something up and pitch accordingly. That doesn't mean that you can't ever have a really good idea and try to make it work, but that would be a slightly longer process than if they have a slot that needs filling. So if you've got a brilliant panel show but they're looking for a chat show, that panel show may well ultimately end up on screen, but it's not going to happen purely from just going and pitching. If that's not what they're looking for, it might be a longer process. I mean, TV is a very long process anyway, but it is quicker if you're approaching it from a point of view of, this is what the channel are looking for, and this is, you know, so we're going to come up with an idea that sort of fits that brief to some extent. I mean, where I'm from the live world, what I will often do if I've come up with an idea, or if an artist I'm working with has come up with an idea, and there isn't an immediate home for it, or it just needs, you know, more developing and sort of proving itself, is that I might well say, well, let's do a live show with it and see how, you know, see how it lands there, because that's a way of sort of proving how something works. It's a way of working it up. It's a way of ironing out the flaws in it, as they will have. And I think that's a good route as well. But none of these routes are quick. I mean, TV is slow, which is why it's nice to have live as well. But it is as a rule of thumb, you're definitely looking at, you're definitely better placed sort of pitching for a slot that's available than just going, hey, I've got this great idea.
Time for the mid-pod break. I'm loving hearing how uni gigs work. I am really enjoying how TV shows are put together and how they are related and collaborate with the Edinburgh Fringe, both in terms of scouting for ideas and people to put in shows. Coming up next is a mid-roll ad. If you don't want to hear it, you can just drown it out by giving us a review on iTunes. 5 stars, ideally, or a 4-star review that reads like a 5-star. That would be fine. If you'd like ad-free versions of the podcast, you can become a patron from $1 an episode. If you think this is worth 80p, there's a link in the show notes, and you can get rid of these adverts. Here it comes.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
And we're back. Before we jump back into the episode, I just wanted to thank you all for your ongoing support in the show and for the questions submitted through Facebook. If you look at the link in the show notes, I would highly recommend joining the Facebook group as you can get your questions asked to the experts through me. We've got some amazingly exciting guests coming on. If you check the group, you'll see which ones have been announced. Let's jump back into the pod.
Completely. And as for, I mean, obviously there's the cliche of if you're famous, they can, you know, it's easier to get a show made, or it's easier to get a show taken seriously by a channel, because if you have a name attached to something, they know that a certain number of people will definitely view it. But I wondered whether there's other criteria these days, just because of, you know, people building up a following online.
Or, yeah, I mean, it's certainly not. I mean, there definitely was a world in which you went, you know, X wants to do a TV show and they go, great, right. What's the you've got the slot, what's the show? Yeah. I don't think that's, I'm sure there are examples of that now, but increasingly rare. I think the marriage of the format and the you know, the principal artist attached are equally crucial. So I think the days of saying, oh well, you know, so and so's really big, so what do they want to do? Is it a panel show, is it a TV show? I don't think that is as commonplace as it perhaps was, and I think the format becomes, you know, far more important. I think the channels as well have got a very specific idea of what they want in terms of genre. I think that one, you know, if that said, I think certainly having a big name attached is going to always be beneficial, or having a big name's not even the right to, having the right name attached, because it depends what demographic you're trying to hit. And if you're trying to hit you know, a younger audience, that might not be the sort of arena filling big names. It might be, but it might not be. It might be someone that has got a really cool podcast, or you know, that's topping the charts, or it might be someone that's got a huge YouTube following. So it's I think having the right name, a name that's going to hit the right audience, I think demographics play a bigger role than they perhaps used to. It would have been, well, we've got, you know, it's mainstream channel, big name, everyone will watch. And I think now it's far more, well, you know, for this, we're really targeting 16 to 24 year olds. So you're not necessarily going to go for your sort of arena headlining comedian. You might, but you might equally be going for a YouTuber or a podcast host who, to a bigger proportion of the public, isn't especially known, but to the audience you're targeting is massively, you know, well known, and the person they're far more likely to tune in on. So I think that's quite a big change that's happened in sort of the time I've been doing it.
Yeah, no, completely, and it completely makes sense, because, you know, like we were talking about briefly before, you know, Netflix is now in the market, Disney Plus are about to launch like their version of that. You know, there's so many places and so many behind the wall places that you can watch content.
Yeah.
That you only have 24 hours in a day.
Yeah.
And now with YouTube as well, you know, I think they said something like 38 hours every minute is uploaded to YouTube.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you're like,
it's crazy stuff.
I can't watch it all. You know, it's just physically impossible. So to core a specific a demographic, it makes sense why it would be their raison d'etre, rather than it being like, we have a famous person who needs a vehicle, let's put them on there. And I suppose, well, I mean, what are your thoughts on Netflix and on-demand players, and do you ever work, well, I mean, I was trying to look into it, I mean, obviously there's stuff that gets syndicated onto those channels and stuff, but have you ever worked on a Netflix original?
I haven't worked on any of those. I think that I think Netflix is a good thing. I think Netflix is just sort of the obvious way that TV's kind of evolving, not just Netflix, any of the broadcasters on demand services as well, is the way. I mean, how often do you watch something live? I very rarely watch anything live. I don't think that means that there's not a place for the original broadcasters. I think they'll continue to be strong, but I think it will evolve more towards the on demand route. I mean, I suppose the interesting thing about that is if you are, the difficulty when you, I suppose, when you're targeting a specific audience, which on an on-demand service you can do more, is that the budgets of those things are tricky. And without being too boring talking about budgets, if you've got something which is going to be viewed by 10 million people on primetime BBC One, then it is a lot easier to spend more money on it than if you are doing something which is going to be on Netflix, obviously have big budgets, but on an on-demand service which is going to be viewed by exactly the audience you want to reach, but there aren't going to be as many of them. So there's that impact. But I think this, you know, whether it's a, whether you think it's a good thing or a bad thing, it is definitely the way it's going. I mean, there's no question that on-demand is the way that, I would hazard a guess, the majority of people under 40 watch content, and probably a substantial amount of people that are over 40 as well. But it's certainly younger people are viewing TV in that way. So that means as we progress over the next 10, 20 years, I'd imagine that's going to become more and more just the norm and the way of doing it. I don't know how that will... I mean, Netflix as well, obviously, the interesting thing is that it's international. So you get your Netflix special on... you get your stand-up special on Netflix, then you are quite possibly going to be broadcast in far more regions than if you were doing a spot on a traditional broadcaster. The other thing as well is with a traditional broadcaster, you're less likely to get a stand-up special just because they don't tend to commission them so much. They might broadcast your DVD, but they're not going to commission an original stand-up special as a rule.
There's less production cost in just taking a DVD and putting it on there
than
them actually making a whole new one, whereas Netflix kind of had the infrastructure to do that.
And I think because they have the international market as well, that you sort of, you know, for however much they're spending and perhaps not recouping on someone that's domestic over here, you're probably making that back sort of tenfold on a US name, but it's sort of cumulative because you have this international platform. But it's definitely, I mean, I think that's a good thing for the stand-ups. I don't know how that will sort of pan out longer term in terms of the traditional broadcasters. But I think they have a slightly different remit anyway. I think Netflix have a slightly different thing that they're trying to do. But on-demand is definitely how it's going to end up being. I don't think anyone's suggesting otherwise, really.
No. I mean, my only personal frustration with on-demand was when something moved from TV to, say, my phone, when I want to watch it on my phone, none of the content changed. And because I'm watching it at a different time, I'm physically close to the screen, I'm kind of, you know, I'm enjoying it in a whole different way. And I suppose slight elements of those have changed recently, you know, where it's kind of, because I feel like some shows are more aware that people are maybe even not looking at it, they're just sort of, you know, they've got it next to them, or they're listening to it like a podcast, or just hearing the words and things. And I feel like a lot of shows are kind of adapting to that. But I remember, you know, very early days of sort of iPlayer stuff and whatever, it would just be, we're putting it up on there for 30 days in case you've missed it, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I wondered whether you have seen a trend in that, in the numbers you're looking at when you're looking at where people are watching stuff.
Yeah.
And also whether that's impacting how you're making the show. You know, like the second screen, you know, people looking at their phone instead of the screen. How are you trying to get hashtags moving? Are you trying to get conversations happening during shows?
I think there's sort of almost two different parts to that. I think certainly you're trying to get the I think increasingly with TV you're trying to get the hashtags and things going. That's sort of without question. The social media in that sense is, I think, increasingly important. I don't know how much when you're making a TV show you're thinking, oh, and someone might watch this on their phone. I don't know how much you're thinking that, if I'm being honest. But I do think certainly you are thinking about how, you are thinking about the on-demand aspect, but not so much the actual physical sort of, you know, thing that they're going to be watching it on. I think what you're thinking about is the, you know, how it will trend on Twitter, how it will, you know, what people will be posting on Instagram about it, and how that might then impact on your on-demand numbers. I don't think you're so much thinking about, well, but hang on, is someone going to be watching this on their way to work on their phone? I'm sure some people are thinking about that. It's not something I've ever especially thought about, to be honest. But I think you do think about the way it's perceived from a social media point of view, again, far more than you used to, because it just didn't matter so much. It was a sort of, oh well, there's social media things there, but whatever. And now it's sort of, you know, you can't make or break your show, but it can have an impact, a substantial impact on how many people watch across the month that follows.
Completely. And just moving into chat shows briefly. So chat shows are increasingly fronted by very famous, James Corden in America.
And yeah.
Obviously, Graham Norton's a big one that you would work with. What are your thoughts on chat shows in terms of comedians on them? I mean, obviously they don't tend to do stand-up sets, but increasingly what I've, because when I was watching chat shows as, you know, coming, you know, as a kid or whatever, I would largely associate them with literally just chatting to someone. Whereas they've started to have sort of sketches in them, they've started to have like little like sort of you know, with the chair and stuff. There's sort of been moments in it that have started to come into it that have adapted them into a different format that have sort of included the audience a bit more.
I think that's come about through purely who fronts chat shows. I think that the comedy entertainment chat shows, as opposed to out and out sort of entertainment chat shows or light entertainment chat shows, as they would have called them, have just kind of evolved. Do you know what I mean? I don't think there's ever been a conscious decision. I mean, each show makes conscious decisions about their content, obviously, but I don't think there's ever been a conscious decision to say, oh, well, from here on in, there's going to be loads more chat shows in general are going to have, you know, all these sort of different items in them. I think it's come about from who the chat show hosts have been. So when it stops being Michael Parkinson, starts being Jonathan or Graham or James Corden or whoever, then it's going to, the tone is going to change, and as a result of that, the items are going to change. I don't think, in terms of having comedians on as guests, I don't think that's really changed that much at all from the sort of more traditional formats to the current formats. But in terms of the nature of what the show is, they are more comedy entertainment than they are sort of serious sit down chat in the sort of Parkinson style. But I think that's evolved just purely based on who the hosts are and who the hosts tend to be of chat shows these days.
Moving into Broken Robot and your production company, how does that fit into the year, as it were, of, like, you know, going around Edinburgh and going around TV channels and things? And how does that fit into the larger space of your work with So?
I always think of my year as being a bit like the academic year in a way, because you sort of have Edinburgh and then you have the sort of awesome term and spring summer term. So you that's sort of the way that my year always shapes up, is that you have Edinburgh, you have your autumn tours, you have your typically spring tours, and then you have the sort of back onto the run of the build up to Edinburgh again. In terms of how TV fits around that, I mean, it all very much depends on personally for me on what I've got on. If I've got a period where I've got, you know, seven tours out, then I'm probably not going to do a huge amount of TV during that time. If I've got, you know, less out on the road, or it's a gap between tours or whatever, that's where I'll probably take on more television work personally. I mean, that, and some of that might be with So, some of that will be with other people. In terms of how it fits in with So, it doesn't mean one doesn't have a huge impact on the other in terms of So's TV. What So are doing on the TV front won't massively impact on what I'm doing on the live front in terms of sort of scheduling or anything like that. But yeah, that's what my year tends to sort of pretty much shape up like. So you're sort of now thinking, you're in August now, thinking about what's going to happen next spring, summer. Slightly terrifying. Also thinking about what next Edinburgh is going to be. Sort of looks around some venues earlier, thinking about next year. So that's what the cycle tends to be from, you know, I mean, you know how the fringe format works. It's you know, Christmas, you start to have those conversations, and then you eventually make those decisions by March, and you sort of move on from there.
Yeah, my thought would be, especially as you've got so many fingers and so many pies, would be if you had a spring tour, it would make sense that if you knew there was a TV show in December, to try and pitch for that internally or even externally to other channels to try and get more exposure for that.
I'm not a development person first and foremost. I attach talent to formats. There have been occasions where I've come up with an idea or something that I've been working on in the live world does get developed, and you do pitch that. So I have some involvement in that sense. But I don't. I mean, in the sense that you mean in terms of pitching for something at one period, that's not something I get massively involved in. To be honest, I'll be from a live point of view. I do, because I'll be pitching ideas for tours. You know, whether that's me approaching talent or agents or whoever, but from the TV point of view, it tends to be, I personally tend to be more reactive to, oh, there's this project, will that fit with what I'm doing? And sometimes that might be development, so I might be involved in that process, but that's far more a case of, you know, someone else saying to me, oh, we've got this project in development or a commission, would you like to be involved in it? And depending on what I've got going on live wise I might not be able to be involved in it, but it's the live side that I suppose is, I know what my next year pretty much looks like in terms of live, but TV, I mean, I suppose this is the interesting thing between the two as well, is that live, because you are kind of totally, it's down to you and the performer you're working with when you do something, you can kind of say, oh, well, I know what now until next July looks like, and I've probably got a little bit of an idea of what next Edinburgh looks like, but I haven't got a clue what TV things I might be doing next spring. I know what I'm doing this autumn, TV-wise, but I've no idea what I'm doing in the spring. And I think that's quite a big distinction between the two worlds in the way that live you can sort of do it yourself really, and you make those decisions, whereas on TV, whichever bit of television you're working in, you're always waiting for someone else to make a make a decision, and so you don't know what the next year is going to bring TV wise.
Totally, it's a lot more control for you.
Yeah.
And you don't actually represent acts, you just you work with, do you work with any independent acts, or do you always work with ones with agents?
No, I work with whoever that, you know, whoever's you know, we think we can work with, and whoever wants to work with us, and whoever we think we can make good shows with. We don't manage people. You know, we work with lots of different agencies, but plenty of people who are independent as well, or people who have swapped agents, or people who are looking for agents. I think for us, it's never really about that so much. I mean, obviously, what can happen is you'll have a relationship with an agent through a particular client, and then you know if things work well, as you know, hopefully they do more often than not, then you might find yourself working far more with that particular agent, and you might become one of the people that they sort of more organically go to say, oh, so-and-so is looking to do a tour next year, or what do you think about this person doing live if they're not a conventional live performer. And likewise, it might be, from my point of view, I might say, oh, do you know what, it's funny you've got that client, I know they don't really do live, but they, how about if we came up with a show, I think they could do, you know, they could do really well and make a really good you know, tour out of it. And so there's all sort of different ways that will come about, but no, there's certainly I've never had a policy of you must be agented to work with us, and I think it's probably been a substantial number of people that haven't, thinking about it over the years.
I think that's just another misconception of, like, people thinking you need a representation to get into it.
Yeah, I mean, and every, you know, every producer and promoter are different. I mean, I think certainly having an agent helps if you want to sort of get into a development arrangement with a production company, then, you know, any production company, then having an agent is probably not going to be a hindrance to you. But I think with live, I think it's the nature, the live community is much smaller, and everyone kind of does know everyone, and if you are, yeah, you know, if you're going seeing lots of shows like I do, then it sort of follows that you will just find good people, and some of them will not be represented, and you know, you sort of just judge everything on a case by case basis, really.
These are the last quick fire questions. So who was the first person to believe in you?
In terms of the industry, well, the people that gave me my break into the industry were Addison and Joe from Off the Curb.
Okay, they offered you your first
they
job.
They gave me the first job, yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
What's one unpopular opinion you have about the comedy TV industry?
That it's far too slow to get anything going. That's my honest, my main criticism of television in general, is that everything takes too long.
I'd agree with that. What's the biggest mistake you've ever made, and how did you overcome it?
Biggest mistake I've ever made is, I'm not going to say what the mistake is, but it was printed in 60,000 editions.
Oh, wow. Okay. I'll ask you after. Who do you think is the most underrated person in the TV industry? You can't say you.
Yeah. As an individual, you mean?
It can be an individual, it can be a group of people, it can be in front of the camera, it can be behind the camera. Someone that you think just doesn't get enough credit for the work they do.
Development people never get enough credit because they're usually not involved in the final show.
Okay.
But they work incredibly hard, and it takes, as I said, a very long time to get there.
Well, I think I know what your answer is going to be for this one, but let's ask it. What do you think is the biggest problem within the industry as a whole, and how would you go about solving it?
Biggest problem in the industry as a whole? Do you know what? I, That's a really tough one, you know. What did you think my answer was going to be?
I thought it was going to be things take too long to get made, or that it takes too long to take someone from live to TV or vice versa.
I don't know if that's always true, actually. I think, do you know what, actually, the biggest problem with it is almost the inconsistency of it, because I think you can have people that are rushed far too quickly from live to TV, and then you've got other people that should have been given their break years ago that still haven't. That's probably the biggest problem with the industry in general is the inconsistency of it in that sense.
Okay, and if you could give one bit of advice for the biggest question people ask was, how do I get on Live at the Apollo? So right. I'm gonna ask as if it is, I know you've done more than that, but that's the main thing that people are interested in here. So if you could give it one bit of advice to a few thousand comedians
kind of shows.
Who want to get on those kind of shows, what would it be? Other than be really good.
How do you get in front of people?
Write
good jokes.
Yeah.
Do you know what? I think it's about having just a really strong hour. I think it's about being able to do the... It's about taking a show to the Fringe or wherever that you think is going to translate to TV. I think that there's... I think you can often do... You can often do stuff and go, oh, this is a project I really want to do. But you actually have to think about what is a project that's going to appeal to a broad audience. And shows like that, not just talk about Live at the Apollo specifically, but any big kind of comedy entertainment show on television is going to require something that has an appeal that isn't just focused to the audience that you might typically target. So do a show which has that appeal. And that's not to say you have to sort of, you know, quote unquote, sort of sell out or change what you're doing or anything like that. It's just about having something which you think is going to have the broadest appeal possible. And I think that's the best way of getting on those kind of shows. Although, just to say, there are lots of other shows that you can do in different types of shows, which probably do feed from a more specific sort of viewpoint, like we spoke about earlier in terms of specific demographics and what have you. That wasn't a very quick fire answer, but is my answer.
That's fine. Well, thank you very much for coming.
No worries. Thanks so much.
Thank you. That was Anthony. I loved hearing about how TV is evolving and its impact on his career as well as production house in general. I loved hearing how he scouts both for TV shows and for people for spots, and the relationship between the different comedy circuits, like from Edinburgh to TV and radio, and you know how they don't work on the same time frame and scale on how you make stuff, but you still scout the same way regardless of where you go on the live circuit. It was really interesting. I really loved putting this one together. I hope you enjoyed it and I hope you got something out of it. If you did, please consider becoming a patron from $1. It really helps out the show and it really supports this community to continue. So if you've got a dollar, even if you're going to do it for a couple of months, if you've got a dollar, please do consider giving it to me so I can continue to make these shows. Alternatively, you can give it a review if you liked it. That's always helpful as well. Gets us up the charts, gets us exposed to more people, gets us more downloads, helps us get bigger guests on. It's all you scratch my back, I'll give you great content. If you have enjoyed this episode, I would love to recommend the episode with Rob Popper on how to make it in TV. His TV show Friday Night Dinner is about to have series 5 out, so if you want to listen to that back ahead of time, I've just given it another listen and it's still as evergreen as when I made it, and it's still got tons of information in about how to get things produced by TV production houses, as well as how and when to pitch shows. Or you could do the episode with Ian Coyle, the comedy commissioner at UKTV, and Dave, if you wanted to find out his perspective on what they're looking for and what they're not looking for. The Ask the Industry podcast is a Fruit That Got in Gravity's Way production for the internet. All elements were created by me, comedian Simon Kane. Thank you very much for listening, thank you very much for subscribing, and thank you very much for rating and donating if you do. I'll see you all in about 14 days' time. Bye!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.